Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh, and I'm joined as always by Frank Cogliano. How are you doing, Frank?
Hi, David. I'm doing great. Thank you very much. How's your life on life in lockdown? You okay?
Lockdown life for me is going okay, considering I'm neck deep in student essays, which is a joy to sort of connect with them in a different sort of way after being distant with them. But yeah, doing all right. You?
Yeah, everything's fine. Everything's fine here. Yep. No complaints.
Right.
My fridge broke 3 weeks ago, but that seems like a minor complaint in a world that's spinning off its axis.
it's the little things in these times of crisis that makes things challenging.
Yeah, and we can't easily replace it because of the lockdown. So it's been a little bit of a challenge living without a fridge. But as somebody who spends time thinking about the 18th century, and now I get a little bit of a experience trying to live in the 18th century.
Yes, you don't have a root cellar in your...
I do not have a root cellar. I do not have a root cellar. Right. Nor do I have an outhouse.
Exactly. See, yeah, your plumbing is not a concern.
I'll take the 21st century. Thank you very much.
All right. This has been a crazy news week, like all of them have been for the past several weeks, or months or years, as the case may be. But one story that may have fallen slightly under the radar, but I think is a really important one with some pretty deep historical roots, is that the U.S. Postal Service is in deep financial trouble and may be on the verge of bankruptcy of a kind. And President Trump has indicated that he is not going to authorize relief funding to help the Postal Service, which has been hurting because of COVID-19 like pretty much everything else. So we want to talk about both the current crisis with the Postal Service and the sort of really long history of mail delivering postal service in the United States.
Yes, that's right. And I mean, I don't know whether you want to start with the current crisis or end with the current crisis, but the current crisis is fascinating because on one hand, it's directly related to COVID-19. Mm. And on the other, it's the product of kind of long-term trends that have been developing, I guess, since email.
And some sort of changes about, well, we'll get to that when we get to things that happened in the 70s with the post office.
Right, sure.
But before we get to the 1970s and the post office, let's go back to like the 1770s and the post office. When are we going to date the beginning of the U.S. Postal Service?
Well, that's an interesting question, David, because there are two dates, and this often happens with my period. There's what happened during the Revolution, which is a sort of often with any institution, American institution or any American governmental institution, like the Navy, for example, they will go back to the earliest possible revolutionary antecedent and claim that as a birth date. And then there's often a different date, usually after the Revolution, when the kind of bureaucracy is created or the institutional apparatus is created, usually by federal statute. So the traditional date, or one of the traditional dates for the founding of the post office, is the appointment of Benjamin Franklin as Postmaster General in 1775 in response to on behalf of the Continental Congress, when the Continental Congress started meeting and acting as a national government for the colonies come states. The next kind of official date is the creation of the Post Office Department in 1792 by Act of Congress, and it was based on the constitutional. The Constitution says that empowers Congress to, quote, establish post offices and post roads. Now, so we can either say 1792 or 1775. It doesn't really matter. The post office, the post office in its current incarnation, I suppose, can claim a lineage back to the Revolutionary era. That, of course, goes back even earlier to the colonial period, because many of the colonies had some sort of often ad hoc postal service. So you probably know, as somebody who went to school in Connecticut, do you know what Route 1 used to be called? You know, Route 1, which runs
Boston Post Road.
The Boston Post Road, right? So it was so Route 1, you know, runs from Maine to Florida, old Route 1, but Route 1 between in southern New England, across from Boston to New York, used to be called, and was called that well into the, you know, the recent past.
It was called that. I think there are parts of it that are still called that.
That's right. Right. And that's because it was laid out for postal service. That is, and the post road meant that the riders would dispatch riders would carry letters from post to post along these postal roads, and the Boston Post Road is probably one of the most famous ones because it linked two of the most important colonial cities, Boston and New York, and, you know, moved the mail along. So there were these kind of informal and, well, slightly formalized networks that existed in the colonial period and formed a network, an important kind of institutional network and infrastructure network that knitted the colonies together. Having said that, there was relatively little post between the colonies during the colonial period. Most of the mail that's going is going across the Atlantic. It's going from the colonies to Britain, and it's mostly letters to and from merchants or planters and their factors in London, for example, or Glasgow. And so much of the mail is carried by sea captains, and it's carried informally, or you know, a planter in Virginia will pay to send a letter or ask a sea captain to take a letter to London. There was a slightly more sophisticated postal network, the kind of origins of the Royal Mail, which has interesting parallels with what's going on in the U.S. We might get to that in the 18th century. And there's a kind of more sophisticated mail system in Britain in the 18th century, but not a whole lot more sophisticated, it must be said. And so there are colonial antecedents to what goes on. And then this... when the Revolutionary Era comes, something very interesting happens. In 1772, the Patriots, as they're called, the people who are organizing the resistance to British rule, organize what are called committees of correspondence. And these committees of correspondence are essentially listservs. They're discussing their internet discussion.
18th century listservs. Okay, good.
They're chat rooms, if you will, to use internet jargon, and they're sharing information about what's going on or the resistance to British rule. And these committees of correspondence equally use post riders to send information back and forth. So when the fighting breaks out in Lexington and Concord in April of 1775, for example, post riders will carry that information to New York and Philadelphia and point south. It'll also be published in the newspapers, of course, but this network of committees of correspondence is a kind of important precursor to the in the origins of the postal service. And then when we think about post riders, and we'll get to your period, but you know, in the 19th century, you know, one of the great archetypal figures of the American West is the Pony Express rider, which is slightly different, but it's kind of a piece with that tradition. Paul Revere was a post rider.
Sure.
So you know, it's moving and carrying information. Sorry.
So what strikes me though is when you're having this post office being set up in 1775. Of course, this is before they're actually declaring independence, but they're also saying like we have our own sort of national system for delivering mail. That seems in some ways a kind of a revolution in itself.
Yeah, I mean, if we're still on the air in 2025, 2026, and I hope we will be.
Who knows, that's a long way in the future.
You know, for the 250th anniversary of the run-up to the Declaration of Independence, that year, 1775, and Mary Beth Norton's new book on 1774 gets to some of this. She looks at the long year of 1774 going into 1775, but the period from kind of early 1775 until independence is declared in 1776 is a really weird one. Because you have the Continental Congress and you have patriots in the different colonies, not loyalists obviously in this context, acting like governments and acting like independent states in many respects, but still proclaiming their loyalty to the king. Mm-hmm. And so there's this real kind of weird liminal period for about. Well, basically for 18 months from January 1775, when the British are starting to seize arms and the Patriots are preparing for war, the outbreak of war in the spring of 1775. But it's not until the Declaration of Independence in July of 1776 that things are clarified. Up until then, it's a really weird period. You're right. So you'd think creating a postmaster general for the United Colonies is the act of an independent government, because that's exactly what it is. But they don't say that.
It's Ben Franklin, and who is probably the most prominent American, if we can say the word American in this context, in 1775. He's the most prominent colonist in the world. I think that sort of speaks to sort of the importance of this. It's not just sort of something they're throwing together. You know, it's interesting that the Postal Service is in the Constitution, right? I mean, I think there's lots of things that people think of the American government they think are in the Constitution that aren't. The Postal Service is.
Yes, because it's crucial infrastructure in the 18th and early 19th centuries. Well, I think we're both in agreement it's crucial infrastructure today. But I mean, in that period, it's you know, this is pre-telegraph. It's the way you communicate it. It's absolutely essential infrastructure. And as I think we'll get to when in fact I should hand things over to you, in the 19th century, it's also important for in terms of the political development of the country, both in terms of organizing political parties, but also it's one of the biggest employers in the government. It's an avenue of political patronage. I mean, do you want to talk about that? Why don't you? That might be an appropriate time to think about the 19th century now.
Well, I mean, there's a few other things I want to mention about the 18th, because I mean, one of the people that's very involved in helping to set up the post office right after the Constitutional Convention is Benjamin Rush, our old friend, University of Edinburgh alumnus, who does, among other things, you know, sign the Declaration of Independence, help fight yellow fever, and is very passionate in his advocacy for the post office, because he says, look, this is a republic. One of the things a republic needs is an informed citizenry, and the way you get an informed citizenry is by giving them access to newspapers. And so the model that the post office is set up on is very different from those postal services that existed in Europe, which were very expensive and really sort of designed towards, you know, profit, actually designed as profit centers for the government, but were largely inaccessible to most people. Rush and other people who are sort of helping to build this initial postal service in the 1790s say, look, we need our Enlightenment values say we need to have a very cheap postal service, but easy for people to use. And they intentionally set the rates for newspapers very, very low, so that much of the early traffic in the postal service is not people sending letters to their grandmother. It's newspapers being transmitted within states and across state lines as a means of informing the public. And so there's a really sort of democratic ethos embedded within the post office from the very beginning, that it's supposed to be accessible for everybody. It's supposed to be this vehicle for democracy and not just simply a means of getting, you know, letters to people.
Well, and not just a vehicle for democracy, but I think your original point was a really important one, and I'm glad you made it. It's also a vehicle for enlightenment, and I'm not saying like the enlightenment, but it's about educating people. It's about circulating information.
Yeah. So it's about the exchange of ideas. You can't exchange ideas if the ideas can't get out there.
And right.
So this is it's sort of baked into the sort of model of the postal service, which grows tremendously, you know, in the 19th century. By 1820, something like 3/4 of federal employees work for the Postal Service. You know, and thinking about the growth of infrastructure of the United States, the Postal Service is really influential in helping to build roads. That's sort of the vehicle through which the federal government assists in the building of roads. Lots of sort of infrastructure projects that have some federal input are used in the Postal Service as sort of the means of doing that. You know, when Alexis de Tocqueville visits the United States, he is just amazed at the sort of robustness of the American Postal Service, because he said he hadn't seen anything like it in Europe, the extent to which, you know, the democratization of mail, the way in which it was accessible to, you know, a wide segment of the population, the number of newspapers that were there, all of which were sort of built upon this democratically structured postal service.
And crucially, David, sorry to interrupt, yeah. It's a national service. There aren't, you know, this in the 1820s and 30s, and you may be talking about this, you know, in the Jacksonian period, you have state banks, you have private banks, for example. There aren't state postal services. It's a national institution, and there's the military, of course, at the time, but the military is very small. It's one of the few ways that many Americans, I should say, will encounter the government.
Yeah, you encounter the government through the census every 10 years and the Postal Service.
Right, that's right.
Now, there are some huge controversies with the Postal Service in the 19th century. Probably one of the biggest one of these happens in the mid-1830s when abolitionists in New York decide to use the Postal Service to disseminate abolitionist tracts in the South. And so they start to send down thousands and thousands of pamphlets into the South. And when white Southerners find out about this, and of course this is not that long after the Nat Turner Rebellion, they go nuts. Like they break into post office, they burn these sacks of mail that have been delivered into the South. They put out bounties on the heads of leading abolitionists. Several state attorney generals try to sort of get indictments against Lewis Tappan and Garrison and other people who they see as being using the Postal Service for incendiary purposes. Andrew Jackson actually orders the Postal Service to basically censor the mail to make sure that this material doesn't get into the South. And there's something of a fight in Congress about whether the president has the power to do this, whether that's a violation of various rights that people have and who has the power to interfere with the mail delivery. But I think it sort of speaks to the ways in which the Postal Service has this, you know, both a very important democratic ethos that we've been talking about, but also, you know, it can get very politicized at a number of different points. You know, another way in which in the 19th century the post office gets very politicized is during Reconstruction. You know, the post office is one of the few agencies of the federal government that's in the South. And especially under the Grant administration, one of the ways in which they helped to maintain African-American political involvement in the South is through the Postal Service. Grant appoints hundreds of African-Americans as postmasters in Southern towns and cities, and that really creates an interesting opportunity for African-Americans who are at that point facing all kinds of backlash by white Southerners against emancipation and trying to make limit African-American political involvement and economic advancement. And the Postal Service for much of the next 150 years is really an important place for African-Americans in terms of having an employer that is not going to be subject to the same kinds of racist pressures that exist in other parts of the workforce. That doesn't always work out so well. Woodrow Wilson does a purge of African Americans in the Postal Service, but that gets overturned by later administrations. And there's actually a fairly long history of African Americans, starting with Reconstruction, using the Postal Service as a kind of a means of stability and as a site of employment when other doors are shut to them.
And crucially, again, because it's a federal institution, not a local institution.
Right. So, you know, even if the state has segregation, even if the state has various other kinds of laws that discriminate against African Americans because this is a federal agency, the post office is in its own world in a way. You know, one of the things that we sort of, you know, you mentioned the Pony Express, which of course really only exists basically for a year, right?
Yeah, it's assumed this mythic thing.
And the Pony Express is a private entity. So, I mean, one of the things I think we should think about in the Postal Service is, you know, we do occasionally have competitors to the USPS. Pony Express is one of them in the 19th century, which only existed for a year. We have Wells Fargo, who was doing similar kinds of things in San Francisco in the 1860s. Western Union. And today we've obviously got a number of private competitors to the Postal Service, at least for certain kinds of packages.
Which is part, I mean, we'll get to the contemporary situation, I know, and we've got a bit of ground to cover before we do, but one of the impulses I think that's driving President Trump in his opposition to the Postal Service is a desire to privatize it, because he or some of the people around him kind of have a kind of ideological commitment to privatizing certain well, not to be flippant, because there's an ideological predilection saying, okay, well, there's no reason you couldn't pay a private company to do this, whether it could be UPS or and to play devil's advocate here, you can see why they think so. These companies already exist, whether it's DHL or UPS or Federal Express or whatever. There are a whole number of them, and so why not just let them do it? Is there a reason? We'll get to why why that's a bad idea, and I suspect in the next few minutes. But that's the launch. It should be said that's exactly what's happened in the UK.
Yeah,
the Royal Mail was privatized, David.
I know, but we can talk about the ways in which those are different, right? So, yeah. So one of the things that happens sort of in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, the Postal Service then the story of the Postal Service is one of just exponential growth in some ways. Obviously the United States population grows tremendously.
The country grows. Yeah.
But the volume of mail in the late 19th century grows 16 times faster than the population does.
Why is that?
Well, I think it's for a couple reasons. One is that they continue to make postal rates really cheap. So, I mean, they have postcard, I've introduced this to the idea of a postcard where you can send a postcard for a penny. And they keep it at a penny for like 50 years or something, so they keep they make it accessible to large numbers of people. They have technology that allows them to transport letters across vast distances, with the post roads. But then when we get to trains, that facilitates postal delivery on a scale and on a distance that was sort of unforeseeable in 1775. The Postal Service is actually deeply important in the development of commercial air travel in the United States. So that, if you look at many of the early flight pioneers in the decades after the Wright brothers, the Postal Service is very much in the foreground there, where they are saying, well, how do we get mail from one part
Seattle
of
to Miami,
part, or from North Dakota to rural places to other rural places, and they Postal Service is really at the forefront of a lot of these technological changes, and they set up a system during the Civil War they start to set up urban mail delivery. So people are, before that you actually had to go to the post office to pick up your mail. But starting in 1864, they start to deliver mail to people's homes in cities. By the end of the 19th century, they are delivering mail to rural areas. And so that's when you get sort of this idea of postmen going literally door to door, even when the doors are miles apart from one another, delivering the mail. And there's a sense, during the Progressive Era, that one of the virtues of the Postal Service is that it will, for the same price, you'll send you a letter across town or across the country, even if, it requires taking a dog sled to get the mail delivered, they're going to do that. And I think that ethos about what the Postal Service does is, sort of embedded within sort of the institution. And post offices are really, many communities, the center of the community. One of the places where you see this is during the Great Depression. There was a project to put murals on post offices. Thousands and thousands of, 1,400, I guess, technically, murals on post office around the country to depict sort of the post office as a site of where the local community happens, where the local community is connected to, the rest of the country and the rest of the world. Starting in 1913, there is really when you start to get parcel service delivery on an extensive level. So you have people ordering things, from the Sears catalog and having it show up and having them be connected to this kind of broader commercial world, even if they live in a very secluded area. And so it really is a phenomenally, important institution, and one that was seen as being crucial to rural life, crucial to urban life, a fundamental part of what made America great was how great its postal service was. It was considered one of the best in the world, starting with, Alexis de Tocqueville lauding it in the 1830s, well into the 20th century.
So what happened?
Okay. I think there's a couple of moments where things start to change. One is, I think, in there's a postal strike in 1970.
Mainly in New York, right?
Mainly in New York, although it spreads from New York to other places. And it's a wildcat strike, so it wasn't endorsed by the postal unions, of which there were several different postal unions. And what's important about the strike in some ways it led to this Postal Reorganization Act, which is when you have the United States Post Office becoming the United States Parcel Service, a postal service.
The USPS is born in 1972.
Yes. And part of the idea behind that is sort of reorganizing how the structure of the post office works, but it also is an effort to kind of not privatize the postal service, but make it sort of self-sufficient and autonomous in a way that no other part of the federal government is. Right. So the postal service.
Yes, we don't expect the Pentagon to turn a profit or to balance its books.
Oh God, that would be scary if that were the case.
Yeah. Indeed.
Wow. Okay. That's a scary thing that's going to keep me up now. Yeah, but it is part of this idea that the post office should have a balanced budget and all these other kinds of things. So you start to find there were moments in the U.S. Postal Service's history, depending on which part you're talking about, in which the federal government is sponsoring or is subsidizing the post office. There are other times in which it's generating a profit, but one of the things that this Reorganization Act does is it starts to cut those back, such that by, I think, the last time the post office got federal funds was 1982. But I think part of the crisis we're in right now is sort of starts there. And there's some other things that are going on. Frank, you want to talk about some of those other?
Yeah, well, I think some of them are, I think technology is really important in this. And so certainly in this century, we've seen a decline in, the number of letters sent. So one of the reasons COVID has so badly affected the post office in the past couple of months or so is because people just are not sending letters at the moment. But that has been a long-term trend. So if there was – I don't have the figures at hand. You may. But, just as it was that surge beginning in the late 19th century of the number of letters being sent growing inexorably, well, we flattened the curve when it comes to sending letters in the mail because of technology, because, the kind of technology we're using right now to talk to each other, because of the telephone, because of the internet. The number of letters sent has declined dramatically, which has seriously impacted the ability of the post office to turn a profit, frankly. And so that's been a problem. So because, a lot of the only things that get sent through the mail now often are, flyers and junk mail and things like that, and advertising, which people often ignore. And so the post office has been in under financial pressure for the past generation or so. But there was an act adopted in 2006 that mandated, let me make sure I get this correct. I don't have it at hand, but there was an act adopted in 2006 that required the post office to make sure it made the pension payments in advance for all of its employees, projecting forward 75 years.
It wasn't their pension, it was their health.
That's right. Well, it was the pension too, wasn't it?
No, there was some misreporting on this, I think. Initially.
Oh, sorry.
Because I did a deep dive on this because people have been pointing to this thing, and I think that's part of it, because what they have been doing up to that point is they've been paying for the health care for pensioners from the post office through contributions made by people who were still working in the post office, and the law sort of set up this thing where they had to sort of prepay a certain amount of
that's
it.
Right. They had a prepay. It was $5.5 billion a year, though.
And it was connected with the Bush administration's trying to balance the budget, and so it was in part to deal with some accounting tricks.
That's right. It was the 2006 Postal Accountability and Enhancement Act, and that required them to pre-fund retiree health benefits. You're right. It wasn't the pension. 75 years into the future, and they had to make $5.5 billion annual payments for up to 10 years. So that meant even before they could turn a profit, they had a $5.5 billion hole to fill. And what's notable about this is no other federal agency was required to do this. State Department wasn't required to do this for its employees, or as I said, the Department of Defense is always sacrosanct. But, you know, of all the agencies, the post office was singled out under this at a very moment when basically revenue for the post office was in decline. There was also competition from a lot of the companies we've already mentioned that, really began delivering as package delivery services like UPS and FedEx and DHL and so on. But also you can send letters with them if you want to.
Well, you can't send first class letters, I don't think, with them.
You have to put them in one of their envelopes and pay $40 or whatever to send
exactly.
them. Exactly. Yeah. You can't drop it in a, that's right. But you can do it if you want to. Plus, online services like stamps.com have taken away a lot of the businesses of post offices, the physical space of the post office. So there's been a whole range of things that have put the post office under pressure. I think it's very interesting. And so that's the crucial background that gets us to the current crisis. And well, I think to some extent, COVID has kind of, as in so many other ways of modern life, is kind of the COVID crisis has underscored kind of long-term trends that have been building for a long time. But
I'm going to take a slightly different take, because I actually think that in terms of the finances, despite all this, hamstringing by Congress, that the post office was actually still generating a profit for most of the past couple of decades. In part because even if people are sending fewer letters, they're sending more packages, and they're making a profit on all the packages, despite the president saying that they're losing money on every Amazon package they send, which isn't actually true.
No, he loves that factoid, or he loves to claim that.
Yeah. I think the big thing is that the Postal Service is being hurt tremendously by COVID-19, like everybody else is, and they're in a particularly bad spot because postal workers are essential employees. They have to deliver, the mail has to get delivered. But people aren't sending as many packages. They're not ordering as much stuff because there aren't people to order things from because businesses are shut down. And obviously lots of postal workers have gotten exposed. There's been close to 1,000 postal workers now that have been exposed, that have been contracted COVID-19. I think the big thing is they're being hit by this, and the Trump administration is saying that they're not going to be part of the bailout like the restaurant industry or the hotel industry or the cruise ship industry. I'm not quite sure in what world the cruise ship industry is more important than the Postal Service.
Not least because most of them have their corporate, their corporate identities and headquarters overseas for tax reasons. So they're actually
in Panama or wherever it is.
That's right.
Those cruise ships industry. And, I think part of it is there's this, maybe it's this ethos that some people in the Republican Party have, that I guess they get from Ayn Rand or something, that, they need to privatize as much of the federal government as they can. And the Postal Service, I think, they say, well, why can't we just sort of privatize this and have FedEx and UPS do all of this work? And as you point out, that actually is what happened in the UK, where the Royal Mail is, even though it's branded the same as it was when it was a government agency, is now run by private entity.
Yeah, it was fully privatized in 2015. It was kind of gradually over the when I came to Britain in 1992, and it was a government entity. There were two postal deliveries a day. You got mail twice a day. It was amazing. That no longer happens. But you're right. So there's an ideological kind of predilection for this. I think there's also a perception, and to some extent this goes back to the story you told about the 19th century. There's a belief that this is an institution of government patronage that somehow favors Democrats. I don't think that's true, but I think there's a perception of, you know, there if you, again, if you've read Ayn Rand and you don't like government, well, this is the way you encounter the government every day, and it seems unnecessary. Why can't you just have, as I said, FedEx or DHL deliver your mail for you instead? The reason for this, however, is DHL and FedEx and UPS and any other private organization you can think of doesn't cover the whole country in the same way. And even, you know, why does Amazon, which is, you know, a private commercial behemoth, why does it need the post office? Because, as they say, they need the post office to go that last mile in a rural place. You know, so if Prime is going to get your thing to us, to a rural somebody who lives in a remote part of a rural state, it's going to be that package will be delivered by the post office, not by FedEx. Or to deliver it by FedEx would cost a fortune.
Right. You know, this shift to having, you know, FedEx do everything might work if the entire country was New York City.
That's right.
But, you know, one of the benefits, the sort of the democratization benefits of the Postal Service is that a first-class letter, postcard, costs the same amount if you're sending it, you know, from rural Alaska to rural North Dakota, costs the same as if you're sending it across the street in New York City.
That's right. That's right.
And which is remarkable. And it gets there.
Amazing. It's one of the great institutions. I mean, it's one of the great achievements in the history of the United States is the Postal Service.
You know, and just think about this, sort of the size of the United States, the fact that, you know, you can pop something in a mailbox in, you know, Alaska in the middle of nowhere and then have it end up in, you know, anywhere in the United States within 3 or 4 days.
That's extraordinary.
It is extraordinary. For almost nothing.
Now let me. So I think there's an ideological desire to privatize things. You're right, and I think that possibly feeds into the, well, not possibly, it does feed into this antipathy towards the post office that one finds within the Trump administration. I do. I've got two thoughts that I want to hear your response to. One is, as is often the case, this seems incredibly short-sighted. You know, Trump loves to point at the electoral map because, and all that red, because, of course, it looks like he won. You know, if you do it by territory cover, then his win in 2016 looks like a landslide. Well, most of those red states are very low population states. And those are states that vote for him, and those are states that are filled in many cases with people who admire him and you know, will probably vote for him in November of this year. Those people depend on the post office. These are Trump voters who depend on the post office.
They depend on the post office more than people who live in urban areas.
Yes, that's my point. So there's that. So I think – so I wonder if despite their ideological opposition to the post office, they may in the end – that may factor into their thinking. On the other hand, and this is my second thought on this, you know, we recently saw the voting, the controversy over voting in Wisconsin last week and over absentee ballots and voting by mail. And Trump tried to draw a distinction between voting by mail and absentee ballots because he said absentee ballots are okay, but voting by mail isn't. And of course, they're the same thing.
Same thing. Yeah.
But I it's very interesting the way the vote by mail, and that's the expression they keep using, and that keeps being repeated and repeated and repeated as a talking point, is somehow seen as suspicious and problematic. And we're going to be debating about this in the next few months because of COVID. I wonder the degree to which the antipathy towards voting by mail, which again may benefit Republicans, we'll leave that aside possibly for a later time. But voting by mail and the mail in general and the post office is being conflated and it's being put in one big ball of stuff they don't like. So the very phrase vote by mail associates in the minds of the people who don't like the post office, you know, reminds them of the post office and why they don't like it, as though the post office is somehow partisan, even though it's not. It's one of the few nonpartisan institutions we have. Does that make sense? Sorry, right. I think you're right.
I mean, and it is people who live in rural areas that would be hurt the most by the demise of the Postal Service. You know, either the postal rates are going to, you know, whatever private entity comes in to fill that void, you're not going to be able to mail a letter, you know, for 55 cents anymore, whatever the postal rates are at the moment. You know, if you're going to mail a letter from a rural area, it's going to be dollars, multiple of them to send it. And
that's
you may
right.
only get mail may only arrive once a week, and, you know, or may not arrive at all, or you may have to say go to the nearest, you know, pickup point, which may be 20 miles away, maybe 50 miles away, and that's basically
right.
cutting off a whole segment of the population that relies on the postal service for things like lots of medicine gets delivered by mail in the United States.
Yep, that's
you
right.
People who have prescriptions, people who, you know, there are lots of people who don't live in places that have, and it's hard to believe this in, you know, 2020, but there's large sections of the United States that don't have high speed internet. That, you know, rely on the Postal Service for doing things like their banking, like paying their bills every month. And, you know, cutting those people off is going to be, you know, it's going to be really painful for lots of rural communities that rely on the Postal Service, and, you know, where the post office is the, you know, major physical entity in town.
But because of all that, I'm not sure they're actually going to go through with it. In other words, because the debate was about whether to include the postal workers and the postal service in the bailout bill, and Trump and his minions, you know, got it cut out this time at the last bill, but there's going to be another relief bill. There will have to be, and I don't think they necessarily. I think ideologically they might be opposed to the post office, but I think when you know, for one thing, there are 630,000 postal workers. That's, you know, there are already 22 million people have been made unemployed in the United States by the COVID epidemic. You know, do they want to add another more than 500,000 to that tally? I'm hopeful that they don't.
You're hopeful, but the political reality we're in right now, it's hard to see how that bill get passed if the president doesn't want to sign it.
I guess. Indeed, but as I said, I think smarter Republicans will realize it's actually in their political interest to keep the post office going because they need vote by mail as well. More of their voters will be disadvantaged by the closing of the post office than Democrats.
Yeah, you know, and just thinking about this comparison you made with the Royal Mail. I mean, to be sure, there are rural parts of the UK and places that are inaccessible. You know, you can send a mail to Shetland or the Orkneys. You know, there are places that are far away from urban centers, but that's orders of magnitude closer and easier to do than rural mail delivery across the United States.
Oh, absolutely. And, well, as you know, I've spent some time in Orkney, and one of the things that impressed me when I was on both Sandy and Strawnsea, which are two of the islands in Orkney, was the postal service, the daily postal service. And, you know, you go to the local shop and you give your letters and they come back and but you're right. Although parts of Britain are very, very remote indeed, it's just geographically smaller. It's much smaller than the United States. You know, the United States has a postal service that spans much of North America. And it's a remarkable historical achievement.
There are 26,000 post offices in the United States.
Wow.
I mean, that's just a huge number of just physical buildings and you know, staffed, as you mentioned, by hundreds of thousands, millions of people. So we got I'd like to hope that, like you, that they'll find a solution to this to save the post office, because it's just hugely, obviously, it's been hugely important throughout American history and
continues to be so.
To be sure. Right. Well, we will see. As usual, our ability to predict the future is profoundly limited. What do you got for last drop, Frank?
I want to recommend a new series on Amazon, or the latest season of an old series on Amazon, to people, which is Bosch. If you've been watching it, you'll want to watch series 6, which just dropped today. It's based on the Harry Bosch novels by Michael Conley, which I highly recommend the novels. And the TV series is great. The main character, Harry Bosch, who's an LA detective, is played by Titus Welliver, and he's the perfect Harry Bosch. Harry Bosch is a lot like Rebus as a detective, but that's another story to my way of thinking. And there's not really a historic link to the history dimension of this. Well, there are two. First of all, the very first Harry Bosch novel, the Black Echo, appeared in 1992, and the LA riots are the crucial backdrop to those early novels. And the character Harry Bosch, and those of you who are writing, are aspiring writers, should bear this in mind. The character is a middle-aged kind of grumpy detective in 1992. And of course, the series, both in the books and the television show, have proved to be much more have given him life and success, which means
so now he's in his mid-80s or something.
Well, the writer Michael Conley has aged him in the novels, and he's coming up to retirement. He's semi-retired and things like this. But he's a middle-aged Vietnam veteran in 1992. In the TV series, he's an Iraq War veteran, which makes more sense because they've made him a little bit younger. But anyway, if you're looking for something to watch, go back and David, I recommend it to you. It's on Amazon. You can go back to the first series and they follow the novels, but the TV show is absolutely fabulous and the novels are great too. So I'm recommending Bosch on Amazon. Very, very good. And the main character, Titus, well, the man who plays the main character, Harry Bosch, Titus Welliver, does a fabulous job.
Oh, great.
What about you, David?
I want to endorse a website I found in doing some research for this episode. It's called livingnewdeal.org. And as I mentioned
earlier. Yeah, we're going to be living in the New Deal again.
Well, I got living through the Great Depression first. But as I mentioned earlier, there's that one of the things that they did during the New Deal was they created these murals on post office, many of which are still around. And what this website is about giving you, showing you where all these sort of art projects and other buildings from the New Deal are. And so it's got sort of an interactive map where you can put in your address and you can find all of the New Deal related sites near you. So if you want to go find the nearest post office with a mural, you can do that. If you want to find other buildings or bridges or what have you that are campgrounds that are built by the New Deal, you can go and search either by sort of the agency that built it or by the location, and you know, for when we're all allowed to leave our homes, could make for some good local sightseeing and see some things of historic importance that may just be around the corner from you.
Great.
All right, until next time, Frank.
Excellent. We'll see you
Cheers.
Next week. Well, we'll talk to you next week, David.
Exactly. I won't see you for months, maybe. But okay.
Yeah, you got to see my beard, my COVID beard.
Oh, wow. Okay. This is going to be something we're going to have to document. Great.
Cheers, Excellent. Frank. Cheers, David.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is Professor of American History and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod, and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.